Radio, EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We've got record heat from top to bottom of the middle of the country. And those are just a couple of the spots that we're going to focus on. But let's start with Texas, where temperatures today expected to hit 103 degrees in Austin. That would break that record for this state of 98 degrees. Similar story in Houston, not quite as expansive between today's temperatures that we're expecting in the record, but still likely to break a record there. Del Rio and more of where that came from as we get into tomorrow, too. 99 for Dallas, 105 for Austin. Fort Smith potentially tying a record, even out towards Monroe, maybe not record-breaking temperatures, but we sure are close and we sure are running well above normal for this time of year. When it's all said and done through the week, I think we'll see dozens of potential records challenged. You can see many of them focused across the Southern Plains, but Kansas City, Rockford, Indianapolis, all included in that as well, where we could see some of those record-breaking highs. Big picture look for the temperatures today. Yes, hot and, of course, summer-like across Texas, but even up into Minneapolis, we're running nearly 20 degrees above normal. So a high of 88 degrees is what you'll get for our friends there. 70s for Detroit, mid-80s for Kansas City. Even tomorrow, 93 degrees in Wichita. Jacksonville has a 90.
Texas, summer heat wave in early spring, like 112 degrees Fahrenheit and 115 in Mexico. That's 44 to 46 C. It was not much cooler up north. Temperatures hit 100 degrees Fahrenheit in North Dakota and northern Minnesota, with tropical nights, which you define as above 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 C. Huge wildfires erupted in Minnesota and just across the border.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. We begin tonight with the raging wildfires in Manitoba. Premier Wab Kanew has declared a state of emergency in the southern Whiteshell area near the Ontario border. The local provincial park has been closed ahead of the busy long weekend. There are 21 active fires across the province, including an out-of-control blaze in the regional municipality of Lac-du-Bonnet. Sue and Richard Nowell died trying to flee that fire. Nearly 1,000 residents have had to leave their homes. 40 firefighters from BC have arrived to help, but officials say they need at least 80 more.
We've had 80 fires to date, and the 20-year average number of fires to date is 48. So you can see that as of today, we are well above average for this time of year.
All this in the middle of May. Winnipeg was 96.8 in the shade, 36C. This is all crazy stuff, but never mind that global warming. We have pipelines to build. It's jobs and money while the house burns down. Professor Elliot Jacobson points out May 9th, 2025 was the hottest May 9th on record globally, with daily records dating back to 1940. And yes, that means that May 9th, 2025 was likely the hottest May 9th in the last 120,000 plus years. May 10th was the hottest May 10th during all human existence, probably. Just the facts. Even stranger, the weather could switch from sizzling hot to snow in a couple of days. Is it just me, or is that kind of whiplash becoming more common? Scientists noticed, checked it all out and published the paper, Rapid Flips Between Warm and Cold Extremes in a Warming World. They say, quote, of the global areas defined by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, over 60% have experienced more frequent, intense, and rapid flips since 1961, and this trend will expand to most areas in the future, end quote. Paul Beckwith has a video out on that on YouTube. Find links in my blog at ecoshock.org. Did I mention the strange dry spring in the UK? Along with the worst UK wildfire season on record already by April. And now we have thirst waves, defined as prolonged periods of agriculture exposure to extreme atmospheric evaporative demand for water. They say, quote, not only have thirst waves increased in severity, but the likelihood of no thirst waves occurring during the growing season has significantly decreased, end quote. We all know the rule that a 1 degree C rise in global mean temperature means 7% more water vapor in the air. But hold on, not really. It means 7% more capacity or demand for water in the air. When it's much less than that, the air sucks water from plants and the soil as it passes over. That is a thirst wave. Atmospheric demand for water makes a guest appearance in our next interview. On May 16, 1972, 53 years ago, great American climate pioneers like Charles Keeling and Wally Broecker met at the Carbon and the Biosphere Symposium held in New York State. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere then was about 327 parts per million. Here in 2025, that became 430 parts per million. More than 100 parts per million, more carbon dioxide up there in just 50 years. That isn't safe for anybody. We have to cope. In our second half hour, a comprehensive new study finds the best ways to cool down cities. We really need that. Dr. Scott Krayenhoff talks to us about cooler cities. But first we explore the dragon. Can the world feed itself as we heat up the planet? There are some surprises here. But when crops go bad, society can go off the rails. Will climate change damage key crops like wheat, soybeans, or rice? Has it already reduced yields? That is part of the life work of Dr. David Lobel. David is professor at Stanford University in the Department of Earth System Science and director of the Center on Food Security and the Environment. Lobel received the MacArthur Genius Award and was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. With co-author Stefania Di Tommaso, Lobel just published a major review of climate impacts on food production. Published in April 2025 in PNAS, the title is A Half Century of Climate Change in Major Agricultural Regions, Trends, Impacts, and Surprises. We all eat, we all need to know. David Lobel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Does farming depend on the weather or on the climate?
Well, farming will depend on the weather, but the weather will depend on the climate. So I guess it depends on both.
All right. Now, while others created models to predict future food production in a changing climate, you looked back. Why?
Well, there's a few reasons. One is we want to know if these models are trustworthy, and so we want to look at how they've done historically. That's probably the main reason. But I think there's also questions around whether some of the stresses we see on the food system now, at least in part, are because of climate changes that are already happening. And then the third reason, which is also quite important, I think, is to understand not just if climate is affecting agriculture, but specifically where and how, so that efforts to adapt to climate change. For example, if you're trying to breed new crops, you can focus on the aspects of climate that are most changing most quickly.
And you find most agricultural regions are experiencing rapid warming. What does that look like? Could you give us an example?
Sure. I think it shouldn't be surprising, I think, in 2025 that most farmers around the world are experiencing change. But what we wanted to do was quantify just how fast that change was, and also, like, how many aspects of climate does that refer to. So, for example, in if you take Europe as an example, they've been warming very rapidly, but the rainfall hasn't really been changing very much, at least over the 50-year time period. And in addition to those changes, they've had a decrease in the humidity of the air. And all three of those factors matter for crops. And what we see is that, for example, the coolest seasons right now in Europe are actually warmer than the warmer seasons that we saw 50 years ago.
Well, looking at 50 years of records, all sorts of data, you find, for example, wheat production is 10% lower than it would have been without climate changes during that time. But wheat productivity has soared, some say tripled, since the 1960s. How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy. There's a lot of things going on. Some are positive and some are not positive. I think the overwhelming effect of technology in the last 50 years is the main thing that you see. But the counterfactual, in other words, if we hadn't had climate change, would have been that we would have had even higher yields.
And critics say plants will grow better in a warmer world, especially with more carbon dioxide in the air. It's kind of like a food for them. You investigated that. Is it partly true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's always been acknowledged. I think for some people it gets emphasized maybe too much and some maybe too little. But there are definitely parts of the world, and we see that, where the warming is not a bad thing or it could even be a good thing. And then certainly the CO2 increases are positive. So with food, we're always looking at the balance of positives and negatives, both in terms of different elements of the climate system in the same location. Some may have positive effects, like CO2 going up. Some may have negative effects, like temperatures rising, but also in terms of geography. So some areas may be benefiting on net, and some areas may be losing. And so when we say something like 10% loss of yield, that's sort of averaging over the entire world, including some areas that are getting hit much harder than that and some that are actually benefiting.
And speaking of that, will agriculture in temperate zones be more damaged by climate changes than in the tropics?
It's hard to say in terms of the crop productivity. It's hard to say that the temperate system overall will be more or less damaged. I think it's certainly true that very high latitude areas, if you look at, for example, Canada or northern China, those will tend to benefit. But if you look at like the Midwest of the U.S. or most of Europe or much of South America, those temperate areas will not be benefiting. And then tropics, it's also a little bit of a mixed bag, but in general, the tropical areas get hurt. Whether they get hurt more or less than temperate areas, it really depends, I think, on the crop and the country.
So wheat is a staple in many parts of the world. Give us our daily bread, is the saying. Does your review suggest there is more threat to wheat in a warming world than, say, for rice?
Yes, and this is not, I would say, surprising in terms of the literature. The effects on wheat and barley, those are two major crops in the world that are primarily cool season crops. They're grown in either summers in cool locations or winters in most locations. They don't like warm temperatures, those crops. They don't do well relative to cooler. And rice, in contrast, evolved in a more tropical setting, does quite well as long as it has water in warm conditions. Of course, getting too warm, especially at night, is not a good thing. And so we don't see like big benefits for rice. But in relative terms, it does better than wheat.
You begin the paper with a question: will climate change compromise the ability of humanity to feed itself? Well, a lot of our listeners have been asking themselves that same question. What do you think?
Yeah, this was a motivating question. It wasn't necessarily I was going to provide a definitive answer. I think it increases the challenge of feeding ourselves. I don't see a scenario where climate change is so overwhelming that we can't deal with it, but it certainly is big enough that it's going to take many billions of dollars of effort to try to adapt our system, to try to improve the productivity that we wouldn't have otherwise needed without climate change.
Well, it's super important to have some sort of crop forecasts. A lot of things depend on that, even parts of the financial industry. So scientists in many fields have tried to model out agricultural future, and when you compared the actual data over decades to previous model predictions, how did they do?
Yeah, that was one of the main goals we had, and I would say that overall it did quite well. If you look at all the different countries, all the different variables that we're interested in for agriculture, so we looked across like the main producing areas, the main crops, the main seasons. The climate models were remarkably good at telling us kind of which areas should warm the most, where the humidity would be going down, where the humidity would be stable, where rainfall would be going down, where rainfall would be going up or staying the same. Really, region after region, the models were quite reliable. If you had like gone back in time 50 years ago and run these models forward with the greenhouse gas emissions, they would have done actually a very good job of guiding our understanding of what's going to change and how fast it was changed. So I would say overall it did quite well, and there were two big misses, and those misses are important, and we emphasize them in the paper because of wanting to help modelers focus in where they need to improve. But, you know, I would say that at worst they get an A- in terms of their ability, and it is quite, you know, hard to get all these things right. For example, India as a country is hugely important for food security as other regions, and wouldn't have a humidity decrease like some other regions. And in fact, that's what the observations bore out, that because of where it is in the world, where it is in sort of the climate system, that's the changes that you would expect. So overall, quite well. A couple surprises. We can get into those more. But yeah, I would say that overall, the models proved pretty good.
Well, one of the surprises for me in the paper, despite dramatic warming for crops in many countries, you find the United States and Canada are like an exception. There is even talk of a U.S. warming hole. Could you talk us through that, David?
Yeah, this has been something that climate scientists have observed for a while. There's this bit of a puzzle that despite the amount of warming we see in other seasons, like in winter, and despite the amount of summer warming we see in most parts of even the U.S., but especially the world, the eastern part of the U.S., where we grow most of our grains, in the summer months, and even to some degree in late spring, have not shown a very significant change in temperatures over the last 50 years. And when you look at this in the relative context of warming all around it, if you plot a map of temperature change or warming over the last 50 years, it kind of has this bullseye around the eastern U.S., which people have referred to as the warming hole, because there's a lack of warming there. So this is a well-known thing in climate science as well. It's a well-known phenomenon. It's not necessarily well explained. People have different hypotheses about what's going on there. What we do in this study is show that in the world of agriculture, all of the growing regions of the world, this is one of the big standouts where the models and the data don't agree historically. And it's been to the benefit of U.S. agriculture in the sense that if it had been warming as the rest of the world, we would have seen much more pressure on the productivity of corn and soybeans and wheat in this country.
Of course, the disadvantage is it might delay climate action in North America if the impacts aren't seen while people in other countries suffer. But the other thing, it comes to me, do we know if this warming hole is temporary or could it suddenly catch up to the general warming?
Yeah, that's the big question. I think climate science, unfortunately, and to their credit, I think as a whole, they have a very active debate going on. Nobody is claiming to know for sure. I think it's most likely going to be a couple of factors that are driving it. Some of those factors we actually think will persist into the future. It's related to kind of the relative warming rates of different parts of the ocean and the land. But some of it is just, I think, good luck over the last few decades. And so in that sense, we would expect it to revert back to what the rest of the world has seen. I think you're absolutely right that the potential downside of this reprieve is that farmers and policymakers in the U.S. maybe underappreciate just how rapid things can change. And if I travel around the world, when I do travel around the world and talk to farmers and other people in agriculture in other countries, and you ask, have you noticed changes in climate? They look at you kind of like you're asking a very dumb question. Of course they've seen changes. Of course they think we should do something if we can. Whereas farmers in the U.S., they'll often be unconvinced that climate change is really a problem. And that, I think, it directly relates to their personal experience.
Another almost surprise for many people would be watching triple-digit heat waves. We might think extreme heat is killing crops, but you found a more serious threat tied into that. What is vapor pressure deficit, and why is that important to food production as the world warms?
So vapor pressure deficit is a measure of how dry the air is relative to how much water it could hold. So anyone who's been to, say, Florida versus Arizona understands that a 100-degree day in Florida feels very different than a 100-degree in Arizona. And that's because the humidity of the air in Arizona is much lower. And what that means is that the air has much higher vapor pressure deficit in Arizona than in Florida. As a human, that can actually help to cool your body because you have a lot of basically evaporation of sweat from your skin that helps to cool you. With crops, a challenge with high VPD is similar thing, but that sweating of the crops or the evaporation of the water from the leaves and what we call transpiration through the pores of the leaves, that helps to keep them cool, but it really uses up a lot of water very quickly. And so one thing we've learned in the last decade in this field is that you can't just look at temperatures if you want to understand fully the impacts. You have to look at the combination of temperature and humidity. So what we did in the study was look at that and found that in some areas where it's warming, actually the vapor pressure deficit isn't going up that much because humidity has been pretty stable or even rising. But in other places, you have warming going up and the humidity actually going down, and vapor pressure deficit therefore goes up very fast. And that can mean that water stress sets much more quickly in farms than it would otherwise. So that's a big concern. It's one that we see, especially in temperate regions. So that, before you were asking about tropics versus temperate, one of the reasons that I wouldn't just say tropical areas are more hurt by heat, because you would think they start off warmer, they would be closer to, you know, temperatures that might damage them, is that the tropics have the benefit of more humidity. And in the temperate systems that are less humid to begin with and that are becoming even less humid over time, the water stress potential is much higher.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist David LaBelle. He has new work on climate damage to crops. When did your study period end? Did it include the large extreme heat waves since 2021 and the seeming jump in global warming in the last 2 years? And if not, would that change the result?
The study goes up to 2023. I would be surprised if any single year would influence things that much. Again, because we look at individual locations, but the statements that you referred to in terms of overall trends and overall impacts are really at the global level. So it's hard to have much of an influence in one single year on these global averages.
Well, as you said, some countries think global warming might be good for them. Russia claimed that about their country. It could expand agricultural zones into Siberia. Are there national winners and losers in this climate lottery when it comes to food production?
I think there will be winners and losers. Whether we can say right now with confidence who those winners and losers will be is, I think, less of a sure thing. It's probably true that when you get to really cold places like Siberia, for example, they are not going to be the most hurt by warming. I think that's pretty clear. In fact, the one of the first scientists, Arrhenius, who really articulated the concern about emissions of greenhouse gases from fossil fuel burning leading to warming, he actually wasn't that concerned being in Sweden. He thought that this would be a net benefit for agriculture and other things. And that's probably still true for much of Sweden. But countries like China, for example, I think have over time, initially they thought, well, we have a lot of cold areas, this might be beneficial for us. But then you start to realize, well, there's other risks associated besides just the warming. There's other changes going on in climate. And then there's also plenty of places that the warming itself can be damaging, even if you don't traditionally think of the area as an area that's too warm. You can still see net damages at lower temperatures than you would have expected. So I would say that China is an example I think of as a country that kind of went from thinking climate change is not a big deal to thinking it is a big deal. Russia, I don't know as much about, but I do think Siberia is just one part of Russia. And there's, you know, most of the grain growing areas of Russia are in areas that are pretty exposed to these warming trends and also these humidity changes. And if they have almost entirely rain-fed agriculture there, and if those humidity shifts and those warming shifts lower the productivity of the grain belt, at least from an agricultural sense, it's going to be a problem. So apart from some very northern areas, I think it's hard to say that there are countries that are clearly going to be winning.
The late Lester Brown, he was the founder of World Watch. He tracked global reserves of key staple crops. Now, Brown suggested rice was already near its tolerance for warming despite breeding efforts. Your study, if I read it correctly, found less climate impact on rice growing areas, and they were partly compensated by increased CO2. Should we worry about rice, which feeds over half the world's people?
Well, any crop that feeds half the world's people, I would worry about. You know, even if it's a low chance of something bad happening, I think you have a responsibility to think hard about what you can do. I think there's a lot of pressure that climate change is place on any system. In rice, I think what we're saying is that the warming that we've seen so far is not enough to really push it over the edge. In some cases, it's beneficial. For example, it helps to grow more crops in a cycle, like more crops per year, because the crop grows a little faster. The CO2 for rice is beneficial, we know, because of the way that it does photosynthesis and the fact that it's growing in many places that are exposed to significantly higher CO2 levels, that's beneficial. The thing that I think most people who study rice in detail would say is that the big challenges for rice with warming is, one, the nighttime temperatures lead to slower growth rates for rice, and two is the rice that deals with a lot of diseases and pests that are going to be and are becoming more challenging. So again, in a relative sense, I'd rather be a rice farmer than a wheat farmer in the overall picture. But I do think that we're not seeing huge benefits for rice, and that's for the warming to date. As you look forward, there still are risks associated with various aspects of the climate. The other thing I should mention here is we kind of took a broad view of a few key climate variables, but by no means did we look at everything. And with rice, flooding is often an issue. We didn't look specifically at flooding. And so there are other aspects of climate that could matter that we just acknowledge is kind of an area that needs more work.
Right. Even rising seas bringing salty water into some of the river deltas that feed a lot of people. Those are the sorts of things. You can't cover everything in one paper. If a dry heat wave hits two or more of the breadbaskets, as we call them, do you expect a year of global shortages of staples, say, in the next 10 or 20 years? Or would it just be prices going higher and hardship for some farmers?
Well, I think to me those are, in a sense, the same thing. People who think of shortages, I think, often have in their view like a binary scenario where either everyone has enough food or everyone doesn't have food. The world is obviously, you know, more complicated in the sense that markets determine kind of who has enough, who doesn't have enough food. And the productivity going up or down in any year will just push that balance between supply and demand in one direction or the other. So I worry very much about availability and accessibility of food for poor people, even in bumper harvest years, because there's 800 million people in most years that still are not getting enough calories and protein as it is. But when we talk about shocks to the system, we're talking about that number ballooning up because all of the sudden, you know, large swaths of the population are finding themselves without enough food. If you have two major problems in the same year in two different harvest regions, you know, we've seen that to some extent historically. When you get that, you get price increases, the stocks get drawn down, prices rise, you get a lot of social unrest typically. Governments try to do what they can to provide the staples to their people. Tensions rise, and then generally what happens is a lot of farmers around the world see prices high and they plant more area and they clear more land for growing crops. And in that sense, the markets work in that the supply does respond, but it takes time. And in the short term, you do have the risk that people go hungry. So this is not a problem that I think is ever going to completely be solved. We can only just hope to keep doing better and better so that we are more prepared and that we have less exposure to these scenarios where a couple of bad harvests lead to massive shortages.
David Lobel, you authored or co-authored dozens of papers on agriculture and crop estimations. You hold a patent for a method using satellite data to do it. You started using deep learning and AI several years ago. What do you think of AI for crop estimates and climate forecasts now? Any exciting developments?
Yeah, I think we're getting much better at understanding in basically in real time how regions are doing in terms of their production, and beyond that, how individual farms are doing. And we can see, for example, if a heat wave comes through or a drought comes through, we can actually see which farms fare better than others. And we can ask, like, what are they doing that helps them be adapted to the situation? Have they managed their soil differently? Have they grown a different rotation of crops? Have they invested in irrigation or land leveling? Or we can see all sorts of interesting patterns emerge and learn basically from the experience of farmers. The one kind of ubiquitous thing about farming around the world is it's done by thousands and thousands of individuals who are really each in a way running their own experiments. So I think AI helps both in terms of monitoring the situation at the sort of national to global scale, but it also helps in learning from individuals and trying to pick out the lessons that we can learn.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about your work as we wrap up here?
Well, I think the challenge going forward, as I see it, with climate change is less about whether it's going to threaten food supply.